Mr. Bates, Rail 5. We're talking about when the Goodall was hit by a torpedo on, I think, 29th of April, at about 19:30 hours, in your notes. You were describing how you were going about the ship, trying to get to the wires office, and then looking round and seeing what you could see.
Well, I realised when I couldn't get down to the mess deck or to anybody that was down there, so I came back out and tried to get up to the companionway to the wireless office, and it was then that I noticed that they'd been blown over the funnel, and the bridge was on top of that. And then noticed also that the forecastle were completely gone, right from the stem to B gun, and the bridge was missing, but the entire forecastle had just disappeared.
Had you seen any more people other than the Fry?
Yes, there was bits and pieces of people all over the place. There was arms, legs, half bodies, all around that particular area, because that was within a few feet of where the torpedo had come through the side and hit the magazine.
What about live? You know, people like yourself who had managed to get through so far.
Well, we were looking around just to see what we could do. And once we realised the wireless office was out of action, Mr. Dalloway came along at the time, first lieutenant, with the chief ERA, and he said that there was 80 ton of fuel waiting to go up, and everybody to go aft the quarter deck. So, picking our way on through bits of the mast that had come down and bits of rubbish, and there was bits of bodies, and one that sticks in my mind most was the lookout, the masthead lookout. He was broken backed right across the deptage racks, and he was completely in two, and he's just steaming from his stomach. Somebody a little later pushed him over the side. I went to the quarterdeck then. There was a few people wounded laying there, and to see whether we could take the fuses out the depth charger to give them a hand, but they had a crew already on that, because they were already primed to go off, because we were going in to attack.
So you realise the importance of that, but the crew were at the rear of ships, so they were all right.
Yeah, they were. Now, I was told to more or less to get out of the way there, because I knew nothing about depth charges at all. So I made my way back up again, because somebody said they'd heard someone. Went back forward on the starboard side. Someone said they could hear somebody calling. But trouble was the ever-ready ammunition magazines on the deck. They were catching fire by this time, and the heat was exploding the ammunition, the Oerlikon ammunition, and the tracer bullets were going all over the place. And then I saw telegraphist Fenwick, who was sitting on the top of the companionway, using every bad word in the language. And I found out later that he'd had a fractured skull. But I couldn't get to him because of the magazines. Gun was in between him and I. I was at the bottom of the companionway, he was at the top. And then I heard a voice, somebody yelling from the door that went down to the engine room. There was a companionway, a stairway going down. I looked down there, and about a third of the way down was a rating. He had a big hole in his back. He was trying to get up, to get out.
A stoker or a rating?
A stoker.
A stoker. Mm.
Managed to grab him and get him up, got him up about 10 steps, I suppose, and out onto the main deck. And things were flying all over the place by then. So I got him on my back and did like crawled along like a dog with him on my back until we got to the depth shaft wreck. There was a bit of protection there, so in between the first break in the depth shaft wrecks, we got in there, put him in there. And there was sort of a still, the sea by this time had caught fire.
So the ship caught fire first?
Yeah.
And then the sea?
Yeah, the oil was leaking into the sea, and I thought it was a very light or something. Go up, make an arc and go down, and the first flames were blue. Indicates some of it was petrol. But the rest of the oil on board was diesel. As I got him that far, and as I say, we couldn't move there, a stoker came along, or a chief petty officer stoker came along, and he said, I'll go over the side. So with this chappy up across my shoulders, I went over the side.
Just into the water, or onto a float?
No, there was no Carly floats left. There was, by this time, that most of them had gone away. There was bits of float net that had been blown to pieces. And there was one piece, I suppose, about 3 foot round, Cook float net that we managed to grab hold of. Wasn't much, but it kept us afloat.
So you and the stoker?
Yeah, and we were followed by two seamen afterwards.
And what was it like when you first went into the sea? I mean, what's the impact of it like?
Oh, to be perfectly honest, there was no sensation. It was just, I don't know, as if you were accepting the fate. There was no sensation. I didn't feel the cold. And we were told on the way up that if we went into the water, we would die a heart attack within a few seconds. And the water was so cold. I believe the water reading somebody told me was 36 below. But I didn't feel any. In fact, before I went over the side, I wore glasses, and I stopped and put my glasses in my pocket before I went over. And that was how sort of calm everything was. There was no panic at all, absolutely none at all. Even the people that was going around the ship looking for survivors, or there was no panic.
Were you one of the early ones in the water, or one of the later ones? It's always difficult to...
Well, I think I was one of the later ones because I was ordered. To be honest, I wouldn't have gone over unless I was told to have done. I would have much rather stayed aboard. I think because all the Carly floats had gone, and as I say, the fire had burnt cork nets or cork ropes, and they'd burnt all that, so that had all gone. There was nothing else. There was nothing at all to go over with. And that's when there was nothing left to hang on to.
And what was the state of this stoker? I mean, he'd been wounded in the back, you said. How was he managing?
Well, it was quite a large hole, and when we was in the water, we meant to hold him onto the bit of float net, and we kept him going for quite some time. But then we gradually began to get weaker and weaker and weaker, and he'd rolled over onto his back, and we were still holding him. We noticed that oil was in his eyes, and his eyes were best part open, and it was all went, and touching it made no difference. And we were gradually getting colder and colder, so we couldn't hang on to the ropes. So what we did, we wove our arms in between the ropes and his too, but he floated off, and he must have been dead, I think, because we couldn't rouse him, we couldn't feel any life at all.
Now, what were you wearing?
Well, as luck would have it, before that we did that last trip, I'd met a Canadian who had sold me a Canadian lumber jacket. It was made out of very thick blankets, and I was wearing overalls and this big heavy lumberjack's jacket, which was blue, grey, and navy blue, if I remember rightly, top. And that seemed to keep me warm. It's a bit, you know, silly thing to say, I know, but it did. It seemed to keep me warm anyway.
And, but you were getting weaker. Yeah.
And the thing was that if I'd let go, I would have gone straight to the bottom, because it was very, very, very heavy. And
what could you see from where you were of the ship, the flames and other ships?
Well, I couldn't see any other ship. As a matter of fact, I couldn't see much at all. My eyes were absolutely red raw, and they were very, very sore. Saw the flames, obviously, and I saw the motorboat, the seaboat from the Honeysuckle. That was later on, though. I saw her coming through the flames, and she was caught in the same sort of U-shaped flames that we were.
Can you explain that a bit? Now, there is a picture, which I hope one day we'll be able to get a copy of, that you did about 5 years ago, which is quite a dramatic picture of the rear half of the ship on fire, and then flames with a sort of... You're right, there's just a space almost surrounded by flames. But
well, she's discharging, discharging oil onto the sea, and she was swinging to starboard. And as she did this, she left a trail of flames behind her. And the starboard side was also on fire. And when the two met, it made like a horseshoe of flames, with just one little entrance that, if you were lucky, you could get out of. And we did manage to get through the flames, but the flames are only a few feet from us.
How did you propel yourself? Just
well, we just pushed, and I think it was the tide or the sea that washed us out, because we didn't have enough strength to move that. By this time, as I say, there was just the three of us.
Could you see any other little groups of survivors?
Or whether they were survivors or bodies, I really don't know. But going looking towards the after the Goodall, we saw some dots, and we was quite worried, because the flames also were going down the side of the ship, going aft. And we realised they were in the same state as we were, that if they weren't very quick, they would be engulfed by the flames. But whether they were, we didn't see any movement, we just saw like heads, and we couldn't even discern whether they were heads or not. It could have been boys, but we thought they were somewhere. We thought they were people.
But you couldn't see the Carly rafts or anything like that?
No, by this time the Carly rafts had mainly gone portside, and it tipped over three times. I think there was about 15, 16 men on it to begin with. Only three survived. It tipped over so many times.
What with? With the waves? Or?
Well, I assume it must have been the waves and sort of people fighting to hang on to something, you know.
I should have asked about the cold, but what about the waves?
Well, fortunately, it wasn't bad at all. It was negating the Eucalyptus. It was a swell, but not a storm. And felt yourself going up and down, that was about all. And didn't bother us, or didn't seem to bother us anyway. In fact, in a way, I suppose it must have helped us to get through the hole in the horseshoe, as it were.
Were any people doing this business of singing to keep their spirits up, in, or anything like that? Or
there's so few of us, as far as I mean, three of us on the float nets, and there was a couple of what we thought was survivors or bodies. The sea was on fire, deadly cold, and no, not at all.
Just did you speak to each other at all, or?
Well, we spoke to saying that where the flames were going and the try and get through the entrance. But not a lot was said. It was, you know, too far gone, I suppose. I know I was beginning to lose consciousness then.
And how did it feel?
Well, I felt like going to sleep, to be quite honest. But whether it was the cold that done it, I don't know. But it just felt like I was drifting off to sleep.
Did he know you shouldn't?
I had an idea, yeah, that something was happening, but it's so peaceful and comfortable. we were warned about this sort of thing, not let yourself go to sleep and all the rest of it. But it's very, very difficult when something traumatic like that has happened. You know, your mates have gone in the wireless office and everything else. It's, the main thing was that kept me awake was the drag of the depth charges. They were dropping patterns of charges. And to be quite frank, the suction of the charges going off, you felt as if all your intros were being dragged out of your body.
And how far away were they doing that? They were after the submarine, I presume.
They were after the submarine, yeah. I really wouldn't know. I couldn't see them. I could hear them, and I could feel the suction, which was pretty. What it hurt, sort of thing.
What happened next then?
Well, I must have either gone off or gone to sleep or became unconscious. I really, really don't know. All I do know is that there were three of us on there then. But when I came to, it was because a rope had hit me across the face. And the other two guys had gone. I was on my own. And this hoarder slid across my face and brought me round. Then I noticed the boughs of the honeysuckle. Captain Wright had put his boughs into the flames and was trying to get a rope to me. I didn't know until recently that most of the ropes had gone, and that they'd joined rope bits and pieces together in order to throw onto us. But it was so covered in oil, you couldn't hold it; it just slipped through your hands. And I was very reluctant to let go of the float net because I would have gone straight down. But eventually, I knew I had to make a choice, and the choice was to try and hang on to the rope from the honeysuckle. So what I did was I rolled it round my elbow and arm and then rolled over in the water. And they started to pull me towards the honeysuckle. And it was gradually slipping through my hands and through my arms. The nearer I got, the more rope I was losing until I was right at the end. And a seaman called Jimmy Wright, Smith, came down the net over the side of the honeysuckle and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. And then someone else came down and they managed to get me over the side and onto the quarterdeck of the honeysuckle.
So he came down and grabbed you out?
He actually came in the water.
You wouldn't have managed it from the sound of it?
I couldn't. I didn't have any strength left whatsoever. All I know is that they laid me on the deck and somebody came along a few minutes later, raised my head and said, "This one is gone." I wasn't. But I didn't have the strength to say, "No, I'm not, I'm not." I managed to make some movement in the end that told them I was still with them. And they carried me down into one of the mess decks. And I was laid beside the engineer officer, who died a few minutes afterwards. I was trying to clean the oil from us, and the diesel oil. They was using vodka that they brought ashore and they was going to take home, and there was paraffin and commission was what, trying to try and get it off us. I just cut our clothing off, and they laid me on a mess deck. I must have made an awful mess of it. And they left me every so often as some of the lads died. I only went to attend to them, to be with them while they died. And then they came back to me.
How did they try and get you warm?
Well, there was a donkey engine. I don't know what it was. It was the tiller flap, I think, and it must have been the donkey engine on tiller flap. But that was running. And they laid me over that, and they rubbed me with vodka and anything they could lay their hands on. Massage it, and I was an awful mess. But I must have been slipping in and out of consciousness some of the time. And next thing I knew, I came to. They said we were going to be transferred to the Vindex. That's a bit vague after that. Well, I know they gave us a pair of some survivor's gear, which consisted of a pair of ovals, a pair of carpets.
Did it give you that on the
honeysuckle? It comprised of a set of overalls, no underwear, pair of carpet slippers, and that was all.
And you're not sure what happened on the Vindex?
Oh, on Vindex.
How did they get you across? That must have been fairly nerve-wracking.
Well, I think they went back into Colo Inlet, inshore, and they transferred us across by boat. I came out of them, my eyes wasn't too bad then, they were still stinging like mad. But I can remember going across by boat and walking up the side of the Vindex, because we being a little craft and the Vindex being the aircraft carrier, I thought I was never going to come to the end of it. But then they took us down aft and gave us a little caboose cover hole and some mattresses and blankets, told us to get some sleep. I don't know how long I slept, but when I opened my eyes, my next door neighbour from home was bending over me, and I thought it was rather queer, really, to be all them miles from home, and the first person you saw was Jackie Smith, your next door neighbour.
And how were you feeling?
I wasn't feeling too bad after that. I'm a bit sleepy and groggy, but apart from that, I'm quite well. We went on the upper deck to see what was going on, and just as we did, an aircraft took off. That made us all dive down. We weren't used to things like that. And as we were going up the companionway to the flight deck, this sort, I think it was a swordfish, I've got a picture of it somewhere, took off, and we thought it was another torpedo or something. We all dived down the companionway, finished up in a heap down the bottom.
And how nervy were you at the time?
No nerves at all, actually. None at all. And we just thought we were ducking to get out of the way of that. But no. It's a strange thing, I think. It's a fatality sort of thing, you know. If you're going to go, you're going to go, and there's not much you can do. When you can't do anything about a situation, I think you just accept the situation you're in. And that's how I felt. And you know, that's not swinging the lamp or being boastful, not at all, because I cried and I cried and I cried for my shipmates.
Well, that is something, that really upset you then, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, we were a very happy ship, you know, there was a lot of jokers on board, and there was somebody who played the mouth organ, and, so we could have a bit of a sing-song if we wanted to. And I never heard of one argument on board, not about anything. And they were gone. I mean, you knew they were gone. We were told then there was 29 had survived. They most mainly were depth charge people and people that was after them. So we knew that we found that there was two. As far as I know, two telegraphists that survived. One was Harry Carter, and the other was Doug Fenwick.
So Fenwick had got away?
He'd got away. Somebody from, I think it was Sub-Lieutenant Bell, he was in New Zealand, had jumped aboard Goodall, and he'd yelled to him to come down the companionway. There was a companionway that went right down the centre of the ship, that went from gunpit to gunpit, oilicum pit to oilicum pit, sort of thing. And he guided him through there, even though he had a fractured skull. Harry Carter had made his way aft. He had a compound fracture of the left arm. But they were taken off the quarter deck by the Honeysuckle, went alongside.
That might have been better for you as well.
Well, it would have been if I could have got there. But
now, so what happened next then? You were just on the way back home, I presume?
Yeah, we were. Cape something or the other we landed at in Scotland. We brought down to London. We arrived in London on VE Day.
What do you remember of that?
Being absolutely flaming mad. We were virtually locked in the train carriage all the way down. We didn't have anything to eat or drink, and it's a long, long, slow journey. And when we got out the other end, there was about 10 of us, I think. And of course, everybody was celebrating. All we wanted to do was to get something to eat, get our heads down for a while. And there was a queue of people lining up for beer and refreshments. And our petty officer went over and said, "These men are survivors and they haven't had anything to eat." More or less asked them to make room for us to. We had no money anyway. To get something to eat or drink. And nobody moved out of the way, so I got very, very angry. I felt very, very angry.
Anyway. Did you do anything about it, or...?
No. It was... If you can imagine, happy singing and dancing, and... I don't suppose they took much notice of what we said in any case. I managed to get away from the main draft of survivors, and I managed to get to a telephone. And Mum and Dad didn't have a telephone in them days, so I managed to phone the local pub and ask them whether they'd get Mum and Dad for me. And I was worried in case they'd heard that the ship had gone and hadn't heard from me, and obviously would have been very worried. So as luck had it, they was in the pub having a drink, celebrating VE Day. And Dad came across the bar and took the telephone, and I told him that the ship had gone, but it was okay.
That was the first, so he hadn't had a telegram?
No. They tell me they stayed there for about another hour, all sobbing out. But I thought it was best to tell them, because I had no way of knowing whether they'd been told or not. There were so few survivors anyway. I'm glad I did tell them, in case they had heard before I got home.
Now, what happened next then?
Well, we were taken to Chatham, and we were given a medical and fresh uniforms. That were very, very baggy and old uniforms we were given, more or less kitted out again. And then we went to see the officer to be debriefed. Oh, we were debriefed once on Vindex by the signals officer and another man. And
what were these debriefs like?
Well, they asked what happened to the code books and the CCM books and things, which we had to tell them that they were kept in a safe in the Wallace office. And as a Wallace office, we'd gone down with the ship. We didn't think we'd be compromised in any way, code-wise.
That was what they were interested in?
Yeah, I was interested in in case, I suppose, the Ruskers had got hold of the machine. And we were debriefed again at Chatham.
Same thing
over again. And then, well, it was one funny thing there. Everybody was told to say they had a gold watch so they could be recompensed for it. So I had to be different. I did really have a gold pen, which my aunt had sent me for my birthday. So I lost that. I still got the same fiver as they got. They all got a fiver each, and so did I.
So that it was just to give them a bit of petty cash with a
well, we had no money at all. I mean, things had been cut off us, whatever cash we had, which wasn't a lot. I think my wages was £1.17 and 6 a fortnight. So from that, you paid your own mess bills and